This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Daryl Chutka, a general internist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. It's thought that a variant of tuberculosis originated in East Africa at least 3 million years ago, with the current strain of Mycobacterium tuberculosis dating back at least 20,000 years. Although easily spread from one person to another, not everyone becomes ill. The management of tuberculosis varies, and although there is a vaccine, it's not commonly used in the United States. Effective pharmacologic treatment is available. However, drug-resistant strains have presented challenges in some cases. In today's podcast, in recognition of World Tuberculosis Day, March 24th, the day that Robert Koch discovered Mycobacterium tuberculosis, we'll discuss the disease, its diagnosis and management, with infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine, Dr. Zami Temezgin from the Mayo Clinic. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Talks. Zami, welcome and thank you for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, Daryl.
Well, let's start with just kind of a general question. How common is tuberculosis and is it still a problem in the U.S.?
Tuberculosis is still a problem in the U.S. and globally. And if we look at three things when we talk about tuberculosis in terms of its disease burden, one is the incidence. So the most recent data that we have is from 2022. In the world, worldwide, the number of new TB diagnoses in 2022 was over 10 million. In the United States, in the same period, the number of new TB diagnoses was 8,300. Or so. So yes, it's much more common elsewhere, but the TB is still with us. The other number we look at is the number of death due to tuberculosis. Again, there's a difference. Worldwide, it's over 1.3 million people who died in 2022 as a result of their tuberculosis infection. In the United States, in 2021, which is the most recent data that I have, a little over 600 people, 602 people died as a result of tuberculosis in 2021. The third number we look at, Daryl, is the trend. And the trend is very similar worldwide and in the United States. So in terms of incidence of disease, there has been a progressive decline over the last decades of the number of people diagnosed with tuberculosis. This is true worldwide, and this is true in the United States. However, during the COVID pandemic, there was a steeper decline in TB diagnoses, both worldwide and in the United States. However, we do not believe that this was a true decline. This was more a reflection of a disruption of TB care, TB notifications, and TB services. Similarly, there has been an increase in death related to tuberculosis in the COVID and post-COVID era, both worldwide and in the United States. And we also think that this is a reflection of the impact of COVID and the disruption of TB care and prevention services.
Is there any thoughts in terms of why that decline in cases has occurred?
Well, patients are not going to clinics with symptoms, because if they have respiratory symptoms, people think that it is COVID. And so they may not go to clinics. They may not be diagnosed with tuberculosis because the focus would be on COVID-19. And those who are already diagnosed with tuberculosis may also not be having optimal monitoring and follow-ups, again, because of the disruption of the TB services. And so all of those things, I think, conspired to artificially make it appear that there was less TB, but at the same time, increasing the death related to tuberculosis.
Okay. So who's at risk for acquiring tuberculosis?
So we lump the individuals who are at risk for TB into two large groups. The first group, because TB is something that one acquires, is transmitted from someone else, another human being, who has active infectious tuberculosis and is expelling the Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacteria that causes TB, through talking, coughing, sneezing, singing, and so on. So the first group are people who are likely to acquire or be exposed to tuberculosis. And then who are those people? So those people are, for example, people who live in endemic countries, countries which have TB more commonly than we have in the United States, people who have traveled to countries endemic to tuberculosis, people who are close contacts of other individuals diagnosed with active TB disease. So, and people who live or work in congregate settings which are considered to be high risk, for example, correctional facilities or homeless shelters and things like that. So this one group is the group which is comprised of individuals likely to be exposed to tuberculosis. The other group of individuals is the group of individuals who have certain medical conditions that if they were exposed to tuberculosis, then they're at high risk for progressing to active disease or tuberculosis disease. And then, so who are those people? Those people include those who have immunocompromising conditions or treatments, and those are, for example, people living with HIV infection, people who are transplant recipients, people who are receiving biologics for various conditions, for example, rheumatological or Crohn's disease or things like that. So all of those people would be at risk to progress to active disease if they were exposed to tuberculosis. Then there are other medical conditions or conditions per se, such as diabetes, malnutrition, and smoking. And so those are also people who would be at increased risk for TB. And so these two groups, the people who we consider to be at risk for tuberculosis.
Well, we know that not everybody who's exposed to a patient with active tuberculosis develops active tuberculosis. What are the potential outcomes for those who have been exposed?
That's a very true statement. So not everybody who is exposed to tuberculosis comes down with tuberculosis. And a lot of that depends on the intensity of exposure. So what was the bacterial burden of the index person, the person who's transmitting the tuberculosis? That's one. The second is, what is the proximity to that person for this transmission to occur? And the third one is, what is the duration of exposure? So all of those things will dictate the likelihood of acquiring the infection. In a very general way, there are four possible outcomes once someone is exposed to someone else with tuberculosis. The first outcome is something called early clearance or immediate clearance. And this is when the person is able to get rid of the tuberculosis, expel the tuberculosis, even without engaging the adaptive immune system, even without priming the T cells, and even without developing a positive tuberculin skin test or an interferon gamma release assay test. The reason for this is primarily a robust innate immune response, the part of the immune system that is sort of the front line of immune system, regardless of what the intruder or the pathogen is. Now, it's not entirely clear why some people would be able to do this and why others don't. But the proportion of these people is surprisingly high. In at least one study of close household contacts of people with infectious tuberculosis, 50% plus actually did not acquired the infection, did not even mount a positive tuberculin skin test response. So that's the first outcome. The second outcome is, of those who are infected and of those who are not able to expel and clear the Mycobacterium tuberculosis early or immediately, then a small proportion, about 5%. So in all the people, then there is engagement of the adaptive system. There is priming of the T cells. There is secretion of cytokines and chemokines. And so the immune system is engaged in trying to confine the infection. In about 5% of individuals, that attempt to confine the infection is not entirely successful. And these individuals would progress to active TB usually within 2 to 3 years after that initial infection. In another subset, also, this is the second outcome, primary tuberculosis. The third outcome is latent tuberculosis, or now it's also known as tuberculosis infection, which is where the attempt to confine the infection is successful. And these patients are known as patients with latent tuberculosis. They do not have symptoms of tuberculosis. They do not have an abnormal chest X-ray. They do not require respiratory isolation. They do not transmit the infection. So this is latent tuberculosis. The final and the fourth outcome is what is known as reactivation disease or active TB disease, whereby those who had latent tuberculosis at some remote period, either by virtue of age or by other medical conditions and immunocompromising situations, the immune system breaks down, that confinement breaks down, and the infection becomes active. So that would be the reactivation disease. So early clearance, primary disease progressing to active disease within 2 years following infection, latent tuberculosis, and then reactivation disease. So these would be, in general, the four potential outcomes.
Okay. Well, tuberculosis is not common in the U.S., but as you stated, it does exist. So we need to keep it in the back of our mind. So what patients should we think about TB, and when should we get them tested?
There are various things that will bring tuberculosis to the forefront of our considerations, even being in a low burden area such as the United States. One is understanding that a large proportion of tuberculosis in the United States is in individuals who were born elsewhere. So that's one. The second issue is that while the symptoms of tuberculosis are nonspecific, so for example, the weight loss or the fevers or the respiratory symptoms, the cough, the chest pain, the shortness of breath, while all of them are nonspecific, if they are chronic and if patients have not responded to treatments for the more usual conditions that we encounter, then in that kind of setting, if they are from the right epidemiologic settings, if they are in those two groups likely to acquire infection and likely to progress to TB, and if they have these symptoms that are chronic and have not had an alternative diagnosis, this is then when we should be thinking about tuberculosis and making either the appropriate referrals or the appropriate initial testing.
Okay. So what tests do we have available? If we suspect a patient, what are the options?
Are you thinking about active TB or are you thinking about latent TB?
Let's say we have a patient we are suspicious may have tuberculosis in any form. How should we start evaluating these patients?
Yes, excellent. So there are a number of different decisions that need to be made. So first of all, if we clinically consider tuberculosis to be a possibility, one thing we can do is test for latent tuberculosis and confirm that indeed that patient has been exposed previously to tuberculosis and therefore is at risk for reactivation disease. So that's one. And that can be done by testing with a tuberculin skin test, which is a skin test that is injected intradermally and then is read in 48 to 72 hours. That's one test. Or there's a blood test, interferon gamma release assay. There are two tests available for this in the United States. One is the QuantiFERON Gold TB Plus test. The other one is called a T-spot TB test. So those two tests are blood tests. So any of those three tests can be applied to confirm that our suspicion that this person may have been exposed to tuberculosis is in fact correct. Second, if our suspicion is led by either symptoms or physical exam findings, then we should make the necessary studies. And those studies would be, because TB is most commonly a lung infection, those would be things like sending sputum for TB testing. Now, the adequacy of a sputum sample is a very critical component of this testing. So sputum should be sent, ideally, morning sputa, 3 separate days, and the sputum should be tested for AFB stain, TB culture, and at least one of the sputum samples should be checked for TB using a molecular test, a PCR. So that's one. If it is an issue of extrapulmonary tuberculosis, then that usually requires a procedure, some surgical type intervention to acquire a sample to be sent to the lab. But essentially, the same kind of things, the stain, the culture, and the molecular test should be applied. Other decisions that need to be made are, does the patient need to be hospitalized? And the answer to that depends on how severe the patient is and what the social circumstances of the patient are. And by social circumstances, I mean, where does the patient live? Who is in the patient's household? Are there vulnerable people in the patient's household? For example, immunocompromised individuals, children that younger than 5 years of age, are all of those things present? And is the patient better managed in the inpatient setting versus the outpatient setting? Finally, as we are an area of low disease burden, the average primary care provider is not very comfortable in managing tuberculosis, understandably. And for that reason, the CDC has designated 4 centers around the country as TB centers of excellence. And the primary function of these centers is, number one, to provide education and training for TB programs and relevant medical professionals. And number two is to provide expert medical opinion on cases deemed complex by medical and public health professionals. So the 4 centers around the country are, for the Northeast, is the Rutgers University. The Southeast is the University of Florida. The center of the country is Mayo Clinic, assigned 10 centers in the center of the country. And in the Southwest and West is the University of California, San Francisco. So these centers are equipped and ready to answer questions and to provide assistance to public health and medical professionals that have questions about tuberculosis.
Okay. Sami, can you talk a little bit about BCG and why that's never really been adopted in the United States?
That's a fair question. So BCG stands for Bacillus Calmette-Guérin. Calmette and Guérin being the scientists who developed the vaccine in 1921. And so it is a vaccine, it's a TB vaccine, and it is made from a weakened strain of one of the strains, the mycobacterial strains that cause tuberculosis, Mycobacterium bovis. And this BCG vaccine has been known to provide protection, in particular to children, from the severe types of TB disease, such as disseminated tuberculosis and TB meningitis. Its effectiveness in preventing, for example, pulmonary TB in adults is much less impressive and is variable. Now, the BCG vaccine is offered in many countries around the world to infants soon after birth because of the reasons I just mentioned. It is not offered in the United States for the following reasons. Number one, we are a low burden country, so that need is less. Second, 80% of tuberculosis in the United States is the result of reactivation of latent tuberculosis. For that reason, identification and treatment of latent tuberculosis is the major component of TB prevention and TB elimination efforts in the United States. Additionally, the BCG vaccine cross-reacts with the tuberculin skin test and can give you a false positive skin test result. And therefore, this might confound the interpretation of a tuberculin skin test result. So identifying LT, latent tuberculosis, is a major component of our prevention efforts. For that reason, BCG vaccine has never been offered as a wide program in the United States.
Okay, fair enough. Let's talk about treatment. What are the treatment options?
Again, assuming for TB disease, right?
Right.
Oh, yes. So, well, let's divide those into drug susceptible and drug resistant TB. So the drug susceptible TB is treated similar to what we've done for decades with a two-phase treatment that usually takes about 6 months. So there is a two-month initial intensive phase where we would employ four drugs. And the traditional drugs for that are rifampin, isoniazid, ethambutol, and pyrazinamide, followed by an additional 4 months of two drugs, specifically isoniazid and rifampin, to complete a six-month course. So this has been the main way of addressing treating drug-susceptible TB and continues to be. More recently, a regimen of 4 months in which rifapentin has been substituted for rifampin and moxifloxacin has been substituted for ethambutol has been employed and has been shown to be non-inferior to that six-month regimen in terms of treating drug-susceptible TB. So we are entering an era of shorter and shorter courses of treatment for drug-susceptible TB. And there are other studies that are looking at different combinations, different durations, and so on. So traditional 6 months, still the mainstay of treatment, but now we have also evidence to look into implement a four-month regimen.
Okay.
So that's drug-susceptible TB. For drug-resistant TB, traditionally, this has been a very difficult disease to treat. Multiple drugs, usually for 24-plus months. So that also has had great advances made in recent years. And so I'll just briefly mention it. So there is a new regimen that uses three or four drugs. The regimen is called either BPAL or BPAM. Contains the drugs bedaquiline, pretonamide, and linezolid. The fourth drug in the second regimen is moxifloxacin. So the use of these drugs daily for 6 to 9 months has been very, very successful in treating drug-resistant tuberculosis. So from the previous multiple drugs for 24-plus month regimen, we now have an abbreviated course, less numbers, and larger success.
How concerning is the drug-resistant organism? Is this becoming more prevalent?
So it's not that it's becoming more prevalent, but it is a persistent public health crisis. So from the magnitude standpoint, globally, there may be probably over 400,000 cases of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. The magnitude might be much less in the United States. I think we had less than 100 cases a year, but we still continue to have clusters of drug-resistant cases within the different communities in the United States. However, of all the people who are drug-resistant tuberculosis worldwide, only a few are placed on the appropriate regimen, and so 40%. And treatment outcomes are worse. And if drug-resistant TB is not identified and treated, then the patients remain infectious for a longer period and they can transmit to other people. The cost is horrendous, both financially and psychologically for patients and their families. So for all of those reasons, drug-resistant TB continues to be a major public health problem in the world.
Okay. For those with latent TB, do they require any particular management?
Yes. So as I said previously, 80% of tuberculosis in the United States is a result of reactivation of latent tuberculosis. So we cannot eliminate tuberculosis in the United States, or for that matter, worldwide, without addressing latent tuberculosis. So we should test the people who we think are at risk for tuberculosis, and we've mentioned those two groups earlier. And once you identify latent tuberculosis, we should place them on treatment. Now, traditionally, the treatment had been with isoniazid as a single drug for 6 to 9 months. But we also have advances in this area. Now, we have three other shorter regimens, and those shorter regimens are just as good as the isoniazid and better tolerated and with a higher completion rate. And so we should be employing those regimens. And the regimens are rifampin daily for 4 months, or a combination of rifampin and isoniazid for 3 months, or a combination of rifapentin and isoniazid once weekly for 3 months. So the 9 month treatment has now been shortened to 3 month treatment, even to a once weekly regimen. And so the advances in that regard as well, and this should be maintained and promoted.
Okay. Well, Zami, you've given us some very comprehensive information on tuberculosis. Can you maybe summarize our discussion with maybe two or three key points?
Sure. So I think the main point would be that TB is still with us. It has not disappeared, and it needs to be addressed. And in this interconnected world that we live in, it continues to be an issue. That's number one. Number two is that TB is curable. But to cure it, we need to identify patients who have it and place them on appropriate therapy. Number three, to eliminate TB as an epidemic, we need to address latent tuberculosis. And latent tuberculosis can be treated. We have better drugs and shorter regimens. I will leave you with the tagline for the World TB Day for this year, which is, yes, we can end TB.
We've been discussing tuberculosis with Dr. Zami Temezgin from the Division of Infectious Disease at the Mayo Clinic. Zami, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
You can now listen to several hundred different medical topics developed for primary care providers on Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts. Find them at ce.mayo.edu or your favorite podcasting app. If you've enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts, please follow us. We're honored to have you as a listener and invite you to tune in again next week. Stay well.